Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm Richard Address, the director of Jewish Sacred Aging and your host for these podcasts. Thank you again for joining us. We're very, very excited to bring to Seekers of Meaning today William Peters, a therapist located and coming to us from a beautiful part of the country, Santa Barbara, California. William has a specialty in grief and bereavement and end-of-life issues, but for us today, we're going to focus on his new book called At Heaven's Door. It's a fascinating read that talks about, the journey at the end of life and perhaps what lies beyond and how we're accompanied, perhaps, on that journey. But anyway, William, welcome to Seekers of Meaning. It's a pleasure to see you. Thank you very, very much. The book, At Heaven's Door, obviously available, I would imagine, at the usual locations, such as Amazon or Barnes & Noble and whatever. And so thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you're well, and things are good in Santa Barbara. There's no fires, as we were talking about before we went on the air. It's a fascinating book. It really is. And I got to ask you the obvious first question. What brought you to this? I know professionally you deal in some of this, but to write a book about this issue of accompanying and near-death experiences, what's your story? What brought you to this place?
Yeah, thanks for asking. That is kind of the foundational question and one that I ask myself as well. And I think there's a rather straightforward response to that. And that is that at 17 years old, I was living a normal, life here as a suburban boy in just south of San Francisco, went up skiing, as we often did, to the Lake Tahoe area, skiing down the mountain, caught an edge, went flying into the air, and had a horrific skiing accident. I crushed my spine. And next thing I know, I was sailing away from my body. And I was looking down at my body, very much at peace. Then I saw a beautiful, solar system. And I was continuing moving away. I had a life review, which is what we, refer to that, seeing a beautiful panoramic movie, if you will, of the life lived up to that point. Then I saw this beautiful light. And when I saw that light, that was the first time I felt uncomfortable and very uncomfortable. I said, I'm dying. I've been here before. I know what this is. I'm dying. I don't want to end that life. And I pled. I grew up Catholic. So I looked at that light and I immediately said, God, don't let me die. I have to go back. I don't want to die. I need to go back. And so after spending some time in that light, I felt a pushback on my body, heading back to, Earth. And in that pushback, I heard this, it was not a voice, it was kind of telepathic, if you will. Make something of your life. And that was it. Came back to my body, did not even think about that experience for probably 10 years. So that laid a very important seed in my mind that was very unconscious. And that was that I had this felt sense, the most profound experience of my life, and completely unconscious, but it was there in some way that was moving me. I found myself a few years later in San Francisco working in basically the Skid Row part of San Francisco as a direct service social worker. This is the late 80s, early 90s, and the AIDS epidemic was exploding. And I was working with a lot of gay men who were dying. And one of them in particular, I developed a supportive relationship to. His name was Brad. He was, I would say, he just was one of those persons who, although homeless and living in a homeless encampment, he was attending and often leading this transition of so many of his brothers, as he called them. He walked in one morning, beleaguered, tired. And I looked at him, I said, Brad, what's up? And he said, yeah, Randy died last night. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And he said, well, I am too, but it was so beautiful. I said, beautiful, tell me. And he said, well, when Randy died, we were all surrounding his body and a beautiful cascade of light came down and Randy ascended in that light. And when he got above us, he looked down and we all noticed that he was at peace, free of pain. His body was healed and he thanked us all for caring for him. And then he ascended further up the light. So those are the two primary experiences. And I would say I had more, heard more about these experiences from persons during the AIDS epidemic. Not as bold as that one, but this opened the door. Later, I worked in Zen Hospice in San Francisco, and there I would have my own, this is a shared death experience, and I'll just give a definition for it. And that is this experience where someone dies and loved ones or caregivers report that they feel like they shared in this transition and often enter into a benevolent afterlife.
You talk about in the book about this shared death experience, which you use in the book, SDE is the term. You talk about four ways that people can experience this. Walk me through that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I identified what I call modes of participation. And it's kind of a tricky term, but what I was trying to figure out was what are the different ways that caregivers, loved ones report their experience? What is the type of experience they're really talking about? And I found four categories, if you will. One is sensing. It's usually sensing at a distance. So it's a remote shared death experience. So you're not at bedside. And this, by the way, these are not mutually exclusive. These overlap. But this experience sounds like somebody reports that they're just doing their life and all of a sudden they feel an energy rush across their body. Their heart starts racing. And then all of a sudden they see an image of a loved one. And that image tells them, they see that person and they get a sense of, oh, something's happened. But then typically that experience closes off with a sense that they're okay. Now, I should be clear. That one, I melded into the second one, which is witnessing, observing. So let me go back and be really clear about the first definition. The sensing is you don't see the person. What you do is you sense and feel something that is kind of tells you something's happened, but you don't exactly know what. And then you later find out that somebody you love died. So if you move to the second mode of participation, that is witnessing and observing phenomena. And that is the most common feature we see 51% of the time is that you will actually see the person dying. You will also see other phenomena. You could see deceased loved ones there. You could also see an elevated non-human being, which is often associated with a guide of some sort, a helper. There's other phenomena as well in this witnessing and observing. The third type of mode of participation is accompany. And this is an experience where the experiencer says that they feel like, or they know that they were moving through this transition, this death transition with their departing loved one. And so this includes observing, of course, and also sensing phenomena. The last one is assisting. This happens in only 6% of our cases, but when it happens, it's profound. This is an experiencer who suggests that they feel like they were called in to this experience to guide or orient the dying in their transition. And many times they'll say, I just felt like I was there. I saw, for example, my mother, she was concerned, or I could tell she was confused. And all of a sudden, the information for how to assist and guide her came to me. And then I helped orient her, remind her of where she was, what had happened, and I began guiding her along this journey. So those are the four modes we see.
So obviously some people are going to be skeptical of all this. And in your work professionally as a therapist who specializes in end of life and grief work, et cetera, has where can somebody go to say, well, these are wonderful stories, but I want to see proof. I want to see scientific evidence that these transfer, these companies, these happenings happen. Show me some studies or else it's just something else. Where does somebody go for that?
Yes. So you're right. Modern science is going to have a hard time with this phenomena, the shared death experience. I should say the shared death experience is identical in phenomena to the near-death experience. In other words, they're both, if you look at the phenomena, and I work with the researchers, you know, in the NDE field, we all agree now, these are the same possible phenomena that can be experienced. So, but in terms of the science for this, the way I came to this was I saw an undeniable pattern. And the qualitative research that I and now my team have performed suggests that this is, for the common person and even just a good qualitative researcher, you cannot deny that a person in Australia who knows nothing about the shared death experience, when she loses her child, and this is in the book actually, this is Michelle in Australia, she loses her child at birth and she sees her father come and receive her son, Ben, and tell her it's all going to be okay. And a headmaster woman in West Virginia loses her son, Nicholas, and she sees her four grandparents come down and tell her, we've got this, Liz. We've got your baby. You cannot deny, you can't make these up. The critique is that this is, the negative critique for the skeptics would be that these are stress-induced hallucinations. It doesn't hold up, though, because we have seen these cross-culturally. People are utterly shocked that they had this experience. Indeed, they are actually quite tentative and a bit doubting of their own mental health at that moment because of the power of the experience. And yet, when we get them to talk in our semi-structured, open-ended interviews, which means we are not guiding, they tell us their experiences, and the pattern is absolutely striking. I mean, my interview team can be listening, and we just kind of start texting each other because our team is all over the place, and we're saying, we're going to see this now, we're going to see that now, we're going to see this, and it just unfolds. So for the skeptics, what I'd really say to them is, if you're really that skeptical, do an exploration. Do what true skeptics do. Don't dismiss. Do more study. And we do have now, our research is been published in the American Journal of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. This is a very, very well-respected medical journal. And I will tell you that the reviewers said to us, there were three reviewers. They all, you know, wrote different comments to us. But two of the three said, we all know these experiences happen. Thank you for doing the research and helping us understand this. This is the first rigorous study we have ever seen. So I think the real question is, for me, that I ask is, why am I the first person as to come across these experiences in such large numbers and find it, quite frankly, easy to collect cases. Easy. Now, it wasn't easy until I started doing, I had enough cases where I could put together a typology, not the typology that I just shared with you, a more rudimentary typology that included an understanding that these happen at bedside, they happen remotely, and then they happen multi-person. And they happen, they can happen, we call this a difference in the time-space orientation. So a little bit before a death or a little bit after. When I started putting this off and lecturing around the country, cases started pouring in. And people would say to me, I had this. I had no idea it was a thing. And I actually hadn't really remembered the depth of it until you started talking about it. So it lives outside our cultural lens of knowing.
So let me go back to the question you asked yourself. Why you?
Well, I think that's why I shared the first my first experience as a near-death experiencer. I think when I started seeing these, I said, oh, I know what that is. I didn't doubt it. I had something similar. And I didn't share this, but I had another near-death experience with in an ICU when I had a blood imbalance in which I hovered over my body for 4 hours in the ICU. And that was another what we call out-of-body experience. And so I've had experiences that make these that I'm now studying, this shared death experience, knowable to me. I can relate to it and I don't doubt it. And now when I worked in Zen Hospice in San Francisco, I had many other of these experiences. Now I will say this, I do believe, I can't prove this up to this point, but I think the fact that I had these experiences also led me to have more of them. So now when I work with people dying, oftentimes if I'm in the room with them, but even when I'm remote, if I've been working with somebody in a end of life situation, someone with a terminal illness, certainly a close friend of mine, when my close friends are dying, then I will tend to have something, not all the time, but some sort of sensing would be my most common experience. If I'm really close to someone, my father died a year and a half ago. I had a very profound shared death experience with him at his death. I was at bedside. So I seem to be comfortable or drawn into this landscape that sits between the human experience and what lies beyond. And I know this is a real phenomena, and I'm committed to really giving it its due, because I know the after effects as a psychotherapist for the people who have these experiences. They offer incredible therapeutic value. So
we're speaking with William Peters, the author of At Heaven's Gate. If someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the website or the contact information that if you feel free to share that?
Oh, yes. SharedCrossing.com is where you can get to me and my organization. And I would also refer your viewers to our Shared Crossing Story Library. There you will see videos of Shared Crossing experiencers telling their story in their own words. This is taken from our interview process. Right. And you'll get to see these people. They are so ordinary that I smile because it's hard to disbelieve people who have no agenda other than they want to get support for one of the most profound spiritual experiences that they've had, often at the same time of a horrific loss.
So sharedcrossings.com, correct?
Yeah, sharedcrossing.com. No S on the crossing.
No S.
Yeah.
Afterlife. You've involved these experiences. You've documented these things. Where do these people, where do we go?
Yeah, I mean, what I have found, and I would say what I'm going to share with you is not unlike anything that you hear from other researchers who actually study, you know, near-death and after-death studies, is that, and I'll say from our research, what we find is our research candidates report that they have seen, they've gone into this dimension, and it is peaceful, pleasant, filled with joy, sublime feelings that they don't have the words for. It is highly relational. The key motif that we see in the shared death experience is journey. So when we talk about afterlife, which is a problematic term, which I don't like, because I think it's just life continuing. There's no afterlife. I think it's human death and then life just continues. In this stage that they're watching, they're observing the movement of a soul, spirit, consciousness from the human dimension into a benevolent afterlife. And there's a sense of heightened awareness that is often referred to as unity consciousness, a sense that they understand human, who they are, the purpose of human life, and every question they've ever had is answered. So, and these are bold statements, and yet we hear them over and over again. So it's, I am aware that the research that, you know, me and my team are performing is very groundbreaking, absolutely. And when I went a few, 2 years ago, and, you know, presented this to the major publishing houses in New York, they were all extremely interested, and they really checked out the research. They wanted to make sure that this was the real deal. But what was so interesting was that just in these interviews with a publishing team, a lot of people were familiar with something similar to this. So there was an inherent openness and receptivity. And I think we will find that. I find that all the time when I'm just having conversations with people, is people just pull me aside and say, you know, I had something like this, you know, da, da, da. So point being is these experiences happen. It is a trade secret in end-of-life care. Hospice workers who are veterans will tell you they know about these experiences.
Do you do any work with death doulas?
I do. It is death doulas and death midwives who are often the most interested in learning about this because they have had, they've worked with, you know, their clients, right, patients, right, what have you, who they have observed having these or having something similar, and they want to know how to respond in a healthy way. They don't want to encourage an hallucination or worse yet, delirium. So this has been very helpful for them to see the research, to have typologies, to be able to affirm these caregivers and loved ones at a time of need when they're already under a fair amount of stress around a death.
So one of the more interesting chapters of many interesting chapters in the book At Heaven's Door is on angels. And you write, I think it's on page 103, if I'm not mistaken, angels, quote, beautiful, noble beings of light, unquote. Talk to me about angels.
Yes, angels is a loaded term. And I will say that, so first, when we look at our research, we have 16% of our cases report seeing an elevated or kind of higher being of some sort. We use the term angels. I use it, well, one, because it conjures up a lot of interest, for one. Now, when we talk about angels, I would say that, you know, maybe I've done 200 and plus interviews here. Maybe 10 to 20, that'd be the range, would talk about seeing an angel. Now, there are some cases, I can think of a handful, where it just fit our description of angels. In other words, a being of light that looked like they had wings. We've heard that. But as we say in the research team, it seems like these elevated beings, if they are angels, the standard issue is no longer wings to identify them. So I think when you talk about angels, it's a loose term, but elevated beings for sure. So I'll give an example, and I think you may remember it. If you're on page 103, there's a number of references to beautiful, beautiful beings or light beings. They don't refer to them as angels always. A few times they do, But I think that term conjures up, angel, a loving presence that has come to assist the dying in their transition. That for some you can call an angel, but I think the idea, if that's your definition of an angel, it satisfies.
It occurs to me, I just have to ask you about, because you in the conversation about angels and the experience that you've had and the interviews about light, and light is a very, very powerful religious symbol. In Judaism, we have a text and midrash about light is the symbol of God, and you know, have the aura of light around in iconography, icons, and Jesus and Mary, and power of light. Where does it? This seems to fit into this. Into what you're talking about in your research. I mean, have you done studies on this? It's just interesting. There's always this light. There's always light around all these conversations. How come?
Yeah, great question. And we do see light quite a bit. It seems to me that, you know, going back to the journey motif, everyone seems to be moving on a journey from this dimension to what lies beyond. And if there is light, they're usually traveling up the light. There's cascades of light. It seems like they're in the light, and or they're moving towards the bigger light. Sometimes we'll have experiences where you see light in the distance, and if there's an elevated being there or some loved one who seems to be guiding this experience, and that's a whole nother term we can get to in a moment, for that figure who seems to appear at times in these experiences. But we often hear, need to go. I've got to go. And this is usually a boundary for the shared death experiencer. That's the surviving loved one and the person dying and moving on. And when that statement is made, or that feeling comes into, you know, full expression, it is understood that they're moving towards the light. They're moving up. Yeah, they're moving up away from this existence and often towards the light.
This is posting in the beginning of February. We're still in this pandemic. So have you had experience in some of your research with people who have survived COVID, who've survived the ventilators, who've been at the border, but have come back? Have you started to have that research?
Well,
and is it the same?
Yeah, that research would lie more in the near-death experience realm. In other words, that's somebody who was close to death and then returns. And that there's a lot of that research. I don't particularly do that research. I more do the research with the caregivers, loved ones, healthcare providers who are caring for the dying, and we're interested in their experience, that the sense that they're sharing in the transition or and the death of the person they're working with.
Okay, so picking up that, because of the pandemic and so many people and caregivers, and many of us have had to do these funerals, we couldn't be in the room at the hospice. We couldn't be in the room at the hospital. We couldn't even be in the room at mom's house, okay? But have you picked up anything? I sensed it. I was in my kitchen, and I just had this feeling that I knew my loved one's soul had departed. Have you picked that up in this COVID thing?
Yeah, we haven't had specific reports of that in COVID. And I will say I'm disappointed by that, that we haven't had that. However, there was a story in the New York Times early in the pandemic about, I believe it was a woman who was 19 years old. It was in Long Island. Her mother was working at one of those hospitals that was in the epicenter of COVID in New York. Right. And she reported that her mother came to her and she died. She was obviously at that hospital. And so that would be a remote shared death experience. I tried to reach out to the author of that article to see if we couldn't get in touch, but we didn't make any progress. But there are stories, and I saw another one that was written about, I believe it was a man who was a radio show host in somewhere in the Midwest, and he talked about driving. His wife had died during COVID, and he talked about driving to work and seeing purple lights on his way to work, and apparently that was a significant color to her. So these are, you know, when you push this, these would be more synchronistic. Well, certainly the latter, the gentleman who was the rodeo host who sees the purple lights, these are synchronicities. Now, I want to say, I am a skeptic myself. You wouldn't believe this by the way I'm, you know, what I'm sharing. But prior to this, I was a real, I mean, I believe these experiences, but to the depth that I get, I've gotten into them now and the advocacy I'm doing for the legitimacy, I listen to myself talk and I say, let's go, let's keep going into this because I want to hear every doubt because, you know, my team, I hired a researcher who was not particularly open to these. I mean, he wasn't not open, but he didn't believe in the shared death experience. So, yes, I would encourage all the skepticism, which is natural, and I'm glad it's there because it's healthy. We just need to explore more and hear more stories.
So we've been speaking with William Peters, the author of At Heaven's Door, sharedcrossing.com, correct?
Correct.
And the book available on the usual outlets and, of course, electronically through the great God Amazon. Last question. We always save the easy questions for the end. All your work, your research, your professional work as a therapist, dealing with end of life and grief stuff. Are we as a culture, William, doing a better job with grief?
That is a good question. And honestly, I don't think so. I think that I think you have to look at what are the causes for the more difficult experiences of grief and bereavement. I would say that when somebody, look, at any time you lose a loved one, you're going to experience loss. It's going to be heartbreaking. There is no way to get through the loss of somebody that you love and care about without heartache and pain. And it takes time. However, we as a culture in the modern age have too hard of a door shutting on a human death. That means the relationship with that person once they die, the encouragement traditionally in a psychotherapy and grief and bereavement circles is to let go and move on, honor the loved one, yes, but move on. There is a huge liability with that, and that is this. If that person who has died is still alive and well somewhere and wants a relationship with you and you want a relationship with them, our research suggests that there is a continuing and enduring bond that is worth cultivating, crafting, shaping, evolving, and it is extremely meaningful for the bereaved. And our research suggests quite dramatically that when you have this type of experience, a shared death experience, or other end-of-life experiences that suggest communication across the veil, that your belief, or the term we see is there is a knowing that your departed loved one is alive and well, that you will see them again, that one's anxiety about how they're doing and your own impending, if it's, you know, death, and everyone's going to die. So if you have this experience, death anxiety not only diminishes for many people, they get not so much excited, but they get open and curious about what this great mystery of death is. So these experiences yield a much different grief and bereavement experience, which is imbued with meaning. In other words, this great event of death, which we don't want as a culture. I get it. And we have a whole medical system that's geared up to prolong it. But if we can embrace this experience for what it is, learn more about it, I think those of us who have researched this, it is hard to discount the fact that something in us goes on. And if so, then the relationship has an opportunity to go on. When that relationship is allowed to go on and evolve and have its own development, that is a better, more healthy, more meaningful grief and bereavement process. That's what I would advocate for the cutting edge of grief and bereavement in our culture.
William Peters, thank you very, very much. It's been a joy to have this dialogue with you. Good luck. Continued good luck with the book and your research. Keep in touch and enjoy Santa Barbara. Great place. Beautiful, beautiful. You're very lucky. Not as lovely as beautiful Southern New Jersey, but you know, it's not so bad.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Take care,
pleasure,
man.
To be here.
And to all of you, thank you again for listening or watching to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. You can contact me by emailing me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com, with any thoughts or suggestions. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support our work, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com. Go scroll down to the conveniently located donate button, click on that, and just easily follow the directions, and we appreciate your support very, very much. Seekers of Meaning is produced at the broadcast arm of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and a big shout out to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Again, I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning TV show and podcast. And in the meantime, stay safe, everybody. Stay healthy. Take care. Be well. Thank you.